And welcome to another episode of Blood on the Rocks. I'm your host, Akshay Taylor, and today I am joined by a very special guest. So, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Thank you so much for having me on, Akshay. I am Moxie LaBouche from the Your Brain on Facts podcast. It's a half-hour show of things you didn't know, things you thought you knew, and things you never knew you never knew.
Yes, and I will be on it soon enough.
Yes, indeed.
As soon as I get my bit recorded. And just heads up before we start, I am a little bit ill, so hopefully I'll get most of it in editing, but if not, I'm ill, it's what you get.
Yeah, it just makes the whole process more organic. You're really opening yourself up to your audience, really letting them get to know you and the whole podcast making process.
Exactly.
You have to turn your bugs into features.
It's all a feature.
Yep.
Yeah, should we say what we're going to talk about today? Do you want to go first? Yeah,
I can't wait because we're talking today about a particular criminal family that has always fascinated me, the Sawney Bean Clan.
Oh, yes.
Hopefully that caused a little thrill of excitement in some of your listeners and open curiosity in the rest.
And meanwhile, I'm going to be talking about a guy from France in the late 1700s. Who was called Tarare.
Tarare? You're talking about Tarare?
Yes. It's one I've been sitting on for a while.
Oh my god. And these mesh thematically.
I know. I was just like, yeah, this sounds like a good time to do it.
Yes.
So, guy that was very well known for his interesting appetite. And I think I will talk about it in my section. So.
I am legitimately so excited that you're doing that topic. I'm not putting it on for the show or anything. Tarare is one of my favorite topics, one of those obscure things that it seems like nobody knows about. And I love blowing people's minds with his story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, so you're getting perfect for this one. So, yeah, Moxie, I'm going to give my guests a choice. Do you want to go first or should I?
Oh, I'm excited to talk about both of these. So, dealer's choice, whichever one you want me to do.
All right. I think I'll go first then, because I'm ill and I want my voice to hold up.
There we go. Use it while you've got it.
Like, it's been all right for the last hour or so hopefully it will hold up.
Well, you'll probably be covered with what we call stage health. I say we because I'm also a burlesque dancer and producer, and I work with a lot of dancers and theater performers and stand-up comics, and you can be just at death's door. But when they call your name and it's time to go on, somehow you have just enough energy to get through that performance. You about drop dead immediately when it's over, but stage health will really get you through.
Yep. So, in that case, we'll cut to music and then come back with Tarare.
Well, he's not around to hear you, so you can pretty much say it however you want.
We'll see you in a second. And we are back. So let's talk about Tarare. I'm going to call him Tarare because that's what Google said, even though like half the videos said Tarare.
Yeah, I'm basing my pronunciation on the Salmonella YouTube channel. But like I said, the man himself isn't around to argue anymore, so we can pretty much call him whatever we want.
Call him Tom.
That's a good French name, Tom.
Oh, also, I am currently drinking a grapefruit pale ale. Is super, super good. By Magic Rock Brewing.
I don't know them. I'm just rocking a water myself because it's 1 p.m. where I am.
Okay, so, Tarare. He was a Frenchman known for his appetite, as it was generally seen as insatiable. But first of all, let's get into a bit of background, I think. He was born in France near Lyon, somewhere around 1772, though the date of birth isn't really recorded. And like I said earlier, we don't even know Tarare's real name because Tarare was a part of a phrase that was used in the time, which was to do with talking about explosions. Can't remember which one I read that from, but I've been through a few articles and apparently that's the case. I don't know French language, so.
No, like maybe the phrase was supposed to allude to he's going to eat so much he's going to explode, like the in Monty Python's Meaning of Life.
Yeah, because I believe the phrase was "bom bom tara" or something like that.
Sounds like a song. Sounds like an old.
It does.
The Victorian era, or like early phonograph gramophone song.
It could have been. There's not too much about when he was actually a kid, but even at the time, he was known for having a huge appetite. And by the time he was a teen, he could eat about a quarter of a cow to himself in a day.
Which is not easy for a French peasant family to support.
No. And it was also, there was about his own body weight, which is, I'm not someone with a big appetite. I don't eat very much. So it's like this, like, what's the word?
Give me something. I have no idea what word you're going to next.
Extravagant, I guess.
What's extraordinary?
Yeah, it's just a very, very big amount. I can't imagine.
Yeah. And at the mention of his weight, every account that I've seen of him, it describes him as being like rail thin, just one of those beanpole guys that you know that never seems to put on any weight but can put away three pizzas by themselves.
Yep.
Like that, but to an exaggerated extent. Were you going to mention his stomach skin?
Yes. Like at 17, he was only like 100 pounds or just over 7 stone. And like you said, he was pretty skinny almost, like, and average height despite how much he'd eat. And essentially when he hadn't eaten, his skin would just hang really loosely, apparently to the point where he could wrap it around his waist like a belt almost.
Yeah, it would look like one of those people from the weight loss game shows and stuff where they've lost like 300 pounds and now they just have the skin that just hangs down a foot over their waistband. But it would be that's like him on most days.
Yeah, but however, when he was properly full, his stomach would, or abdomen area would essentially inflate like a balloon. And apparently when it would, his eyes would also be bloodshot and an odor, which he was known for being really smelly as it was. Apparently you could smell him pretty heavily from about 20 meters away.
Well, you gotta think of the meat sweats times one quarter of a cow.
Yeah, essentially.
And that's going to be significant. And now the people who are reporting to us that he smelled bad are, again, I want to stress, French peasants.
Yep.
So if they say that he smelled bad, you can take that to the bank.
So yeah, on top of that, apparently the skin of his cheeks was also really loose and wrinkled up. But when he like filled his mouth, he could hold about 12 eggs or apples in his mouth at the same time.
So yeah, Tarare would have had to have had a very large mouth, not only the skin of his cheeks, but to put away the volume of food that he did in any reasonable sense of time, not that reasonable is going to factor a great deal in his life, he would also have had to have had exceptional jaw muscles. If you're talking about eating upwards of a quarter of a cow.
Yeah, probably like when later on when he was actually dissected, it was about 4 inches wide when it was open to lean back.
Yeah, that's considerably larger than I can open my mouth. And as someone who hasn't stopped speaking since she was 9 months old, that's saying something.
It's quite a feature.
Yeah, there you go. Not a bug, a feature.
Yeah. But yeah, like I said, when he'd eaten, the vapor would essentially become visible.
Actual stink lines.
Yeah. And he'd become really lethargic. And during that time, he'd apparently belch a lot. Yeah, and it was quite common for him to have chronic diarrhea quite often.
Yes, in the pre-toilet tissue era, in the pre-indoor plumbing era, you know, his evacuations would have been the stuff of nightmares.
Yep. Apparently, the quote that I've seen is "fetid beyond all conception."
I like that.
Yeah. It's definitely a choice of words.
Yeah, I'm going to hold on to that next time I've got an applicable situation.
Mm-hmm. But apparently, despite him eating so much, he never really vomited that much or gained weight.
You know, I wonder if something in his anatomy could have prevented him from vomiting, because any number of animals, rabbits, horses, for example, can't vomit. I wonder if it was a one-way street with him.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a really weird one. Like, there were some theories to why it was the case. The main ones I've seen were hyperthyroidism.
Yeah, a thyroid storm could definitely cause... It cranks your metabolism. It overclocks your metabolism, yeah. And you're metabolizing so fast you can't put enough food in yourself to keep up with it. Though that wouldn't account for the unusual anatomy and the way his body accommodated the amount of food he was taking in. I guess, I don't know, maybe if he was just doing it so consistently over so many years, maybe his abdomen would have adapted to being able to take in the huge quantity of food that his overclocked metabolic system needed.
Yeah, because essentially hypothyroidism, it can cause stuff like extreme appetite, rapid weight loss, heavy sweating, and heat intolerance.
Yeah.
But there was another guy that also said that he might have had a damaged amygdala.
Amygdala?
Yes. Uh-huh. As apparently, injuries to the amygdala in animals can cause polyphagia, which is actually the insatiable hunger.
Hmm. See, everything I know about the amygdala comes from one line of dialogue from Firefly. So that would the more you know.
Yeah. Good show, by the way. But yeah, so there's like a lot of things for some reason it was a combination of the two of those.
Yeah, it could have been more than one condition at once, or it could be something that is just so rare we haven't been able to document it since.
So from what I've seen, it's generally seen as a combination of the hyperthyroidism and the damage at the same time, kind of driving the hunger into overdrive.
Yeah, that scans. We'll go with that.
I don't know medicine that well, so call me out on it if you want. Okay.
Yes, if there are any MDs or, we'll take registered nurses or nurse practitioners in the audience, please hop on the social media and let us know.
Like, when he was home as a kid, late teens, there was a point where his parents couldn't really provide for him, and there's a split between whether he was forced to leave home or whether he ran away. Generally, things seem to lean towards forced to leave.
He also might have just known that he would know that his parents couldn't afford to feed him.
Yeah. It's hard to say whether it was actually just him running away because of it, or...
Yeah, or it could have been like when you quit while your boss is in the middle of firing you.
Yeah.
And then you can argue about who broke up with who later.
And essentially after that, he spent some years touring the country with a roaming band of thieves and prostitutes, apparently. And yeah, essentially going around begging and stealing for food. Until after a while, he took up a job of working as a traveling charlatan. Or performer, and he'd draw his crowd by eating pretty much anything people brought to him. I think one of the main ones that I've seen is eating an entire bag or basket full of apples, along with a bunch of corks, stones, and stuff like that, like all in one sitting.
Yeah, not part of a balanced breakfast, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
The cork wouldn't be too bad because it is the inner bark of a tree, at least it's plant material, and I guess the stones would make him feel full for a little while, but... Really, it's not paleo. I wouldn't recommend this for anybody.
No, not really. But I know there were some dinosaurs that ate stones to help them digest, mm-hmm. But I don't think it works that way in people.
No, chickens, though. Chickens and a lot of birds do that. Humans, not so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did get very badly sick from one of his... when you're a street performer, you're also called a busker. So one of his days busking did lead to him being badly sick and hospitalized, if I remember the story correctly.
But yeah, you're right. It was actually after he moved to Paris, working as a street performer there, he was pretty successful. But once the act essentially went wrong and he got he ended up with severe intestinal obstructions, which led to members of the crowd carrying him to the Hotel du Hospital, which must mean it was pretty popular at least.
Yeah, decently popular enough that they didn't want him to die right in front of them.
Yeah.
That is a tough act to follow.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And he was treated with powerful laxatives and made a full recovery.
So that would have been probably mercury, given the time period.
I'm not quite sure what it was, actually.
I'm just thinking that if you need to evacuate someone in that period in history, it was back in the time where we discovered an element. Let's eat it just in case it's medicine.
Pretty much.
And then 30 years later, we found out, oh, crap, that wasn't medicine. Oh, well. I'm thinking it might have been been mercury.
Moving on anyway to the few years onwards, when the War of the First Coalition broke out in France.
Terah joined the French Revolutionary Army, but military rations, not so great for him, and he was still always hungry. So what he'd do he'd help out other soldiers and stuff with whatever work they had, and they'd give him like scraps of their rations and stuff like that to help him feed a bit. But it still wasn't enough, so he'd also scavenge from the dung heap and wherever he could find any kind of intake, essentially. But despite this, he was still admitted to the military hospital at Soltzhaut-Rhin with a case of extreme exhaustion, as he just wasn't getting enough to eat.
Yeah, because if he had the metabolic conditions, his body would require huge amounts of energy. And then if he's, you know, trying to subsist on military rations, which for cost effectiveness are the least amount of food they can feed you and still have you do your job, then it would actually have been very taxing on his body, whereas it wouldn't have been a problem at all for the average person.
Yep. And when he got into the military hospital, he was given quadruple rations. But still,
banner day for Terare.
Yeah, yeah. But still, he was super hungry, so he'd scavenge for whatever he could find in like gutters and containers. He'd eat food left over by other patients. Apparently, he occasionally crept into the apothecary's room to eat poultices and stuff like that.
He just randomly eats stuff out of the pharmacy. That's always a good idea.
So, yeah, people were pretty interested in him. And like the military was just like, maybe we could use this for a bit, or maybe we could at least understand it. So Terah was essentially ordered to remain in the military hospital to take part in physiological experiments designed by a Dr. Corville, who was the surgeon to the 9th Hussar Regiment, and also George Didier and Baron Percy, who was the surgeon chief of the hospital. And yeah, so they decided to test Terah's capacity for food. So they prepared a meal for 15 laborers and put it at the hospital gates. And unlike normal, this time they didn't restrain Terah in the presence of all this food, and they let him eat undisturbed. And he ate the entire meal of about 2 large meat pies, some plates of grease and salt, and 4 gallons of milk before falling asleep.
Take that YouTube gallon of milk challenge from like 8 years ago.
That is a lot of food.
Terare could do the gallon of milk challenge, the cinnamon challenge, whatever you got.
Yeah, pretty much, like, for 15 people.
And this is 100-pound man.
Yeah. And like I said earlier, when he ate a lot, his body became very, like, inflated like a balloon. And this happened once again. And just a warning, this has a bit of a animal cruelty, so skip ahead a couple of minutes if...
You just might want to hit forward 30 a couple of times.
Yeah.
Just because I know where this is going.
Yeah. So that's the warning out of it, at least. So there was another occasion where Terah was essentially presented with a live cat by the military, and he proceeded to eat the cat by tearing its abdomen open with his teeth and drinking its blood before eating the entire cat, apart from the bones. And afterwards, he apparently vomited up the fur and skin, which is apparently quite common in carnivores.
Basically just coughed it up like an owl pellet.
Yeah. And after this, the hospital starts went like, maybe we shouldn't do this. We should do it more.
Well, that's most science. Well, this didn't kill him. Let's give him some more.
So they offered him all kinds of other animals. Apparently, in one case, he swallowed an entire eel without chewing.
Yes, and for those who don't understand why that's significant, please Google eel skeleton. It's basically like a giant comb made of razors. So there would have come a point where the flesh had been digested off of the skeleton and just left hundreds of pointy shards of bone behind. But for Terare, it's no big. Just another day in the life.
And he essentially spent several months under experimental conditions. But after a while, military authorities started pressing him to be returned to active duty, as he was still a soldier. But Dr. Corville was still... He still wanted to keep investigating eating habits and stuff. So he went up to General Alexander de Beauharnais.
If you give me the spelling, I should be able to pronounce it for you.
B-E-A-U.
Mm-hmm.
H-A-R-N-A-I-S.
Oh, I'd say Beauharnais.
Beauharnais.
That
sounds right.
Yeah.
Okay. And, yeah, essentially went up to him and was like, this guy over here, he can eat essentially anything. We can figure out a way to put this to military use. So they came up with a plan to make Tara eat a wooden box, essentially wait for it to pass through a system, and they'd try and retrieve the box from his excrement with a document inside of it.
Yeah, the idea was that would be how he would smuggle messages, because, you know, you would find it in someone's boot or hidden amongst their possessions, but not in their colon, we hope.
Yeah, essentially. And yeah, well, in the tests, it worked fine. Like, the document was retrieved in legible condition 2 days after he ate it. So they decided to put it to an actual test and gave Tara the job of a military courier, because essentially if he ate the box, they wouldn't find it if it was searched. So they gave him a box with what they told him was a important military document. And after he ate the box, he was given as a reward, he was given a wheelbarrow filled with 30 pounds or 14 kilos of raw bull's lungs and liver, which he apparently immediately ate in front of all generals.
Yay. This wheelbarrow full of organs. And I don't know why I'm trying to apply normal people, you know, medical knowledge to this guy, but I'm like, you know, all those organs, you're going to get gout.
Yeah.
But gout is low on his list of problems.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I'm not sure if normal people physiologically works with this guy. But after this demonstration, he was officially employed as a spy of the Army of the Rhine. But General de Beauharnais, he was pretty convinced of the ability to do it, but he was still unsure whether he could trust him with important military documents. So for his first assignment, he was given a message to carry to a colonel that was imprisoned by the Prussians, was told the documents were really important, and sent off. But the document was just a note saying that he should return another note, saying that a message had been received successfully.
Yeah, he was effectively pinging the other guy. He was just pinging this colonel via Tarare's intestines.
Yeah, yeah. However, after he went off, pretty soon after, he was captured outside of Lambeau, because, like, even though he was just a normal dude going through, he was going through disguised as a German peasant, but he couldn't speak German.
Yeah, tiny oversight in the planning there.
And he was essentially kept in prison for 24 hours and refused to talk. After about 24 hours, he explained his scheme to his captors and was chained to a latrine. And about 30 hours after it was swallowed, the box emerged. Now, there's two things I've read about this. One was that General Zogli of the Prussians, he got the box and was furious to read that it was just a little note, and accused Tara of mocking him. So Tara was taken to a gallows with a noose placed around his neck before Zogli relented and let him go with a severe beating. But other sources essentially say that Zogli never actually got the box, because Tara, after excreting it, he apparently ate the stool containing the box before it could be seized. So...
No.
Yeah, no. Not great.
No.
Not
great. No. No coprophagia.
Yeah.
Which, for those who didn't know, is the Latin term for poop eating. Coprophagia. This has been your word of the day.
Yeah, essentially after he was released, Tarare essentially went as far as he could to avoid any further military service, because that can be pretty traumatic.
Yeah, he didn't have a good time. It was not a fun furlough.
Yeah, so he essentially returned to the hospitals telling them that he'd attempt any possible cure for his appetite. Baron Percy was the surgeon-in-chief of the hospital. He treated him with laudanum with no success, and also with wine vinegar and tobacco pills, also unsuccessful. And he tried all kinds of things, like eating large amounts of boiled eggs, etc., etc. But all of this failed. So, similar to as he was before, he'd sneak around and try and get food wherever he can. Like, he'd sneak out of the hospital to scavenge for offal outside of butcher shops, and he'd fight stray dogs for carrying gutters, alleys, and rubbish heaps and stuff like that. And a few times, he was caught in the hospital drinking blood from patients undergoing bloodletting. and apparently attempting to eat bodies from the mortuary.
Hey, look, he's just trying to cut down on the waste, okay? You know, he's trying to reduce the hospital's carbon footprint by making sure that nothing goes to waste. He's trying to use every part of the human animal. Don't want to just let all that excellent blood go down the gutter, and, you know, bodies are a hassle to deal with anyway. Just let him have them.
Yeah, essentially.
Also, let's remember, this is pre-refrigeration that he's eating these bodies.
Yeah, yeah. These will not be fresh bodies most of the time.
No.
I mean, they might be. They were at war. So, who knows?
Yeah, you got to time it just right, though.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, other doctors would press for Tara to be transferred to a lunatic asylum, but Baron Percy was pretty keen to keep experimenting on him, so he stayed in a military hospital. And it was like this quite well, but sometime later, a 14-month-old child went missing from the hospital. So obviously Tara was suspected. And Baron Percy was either unable or unwilling to defend him. So Tara was chased from the hospital and never returned. He kind of went off the radar for the next 4 years.
Yeah, garbage dump is one thing. Morgue, starting to push it. Missing baby, get the fuck out.
Yeah, essentially. And 4 years later, 1798 comes around, and someone called M. Tessier from Versailles Hospital contacted Percy about a patient of theirs. And the patient of theirs wanted to see him. And this turned out to be Tara, who at this point was pretty bedridden and weak.
Did he have the consumption?
He had a consumption.
Which is an ironic disease for him to get when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah. He told Baron Percy that he'd swallowed a golden fort 2 years earlier that he believed was lodged inside of him and caused his weakness. Percy essentially took one look at him and realized that he had advanced tuberculosis or the consumption in his late stages.
And, where did he get a golden fork?
I don't question these things after a while reading about it.
Well, no, it's actually, interestingly, coincidentally, high in my thinking, because listening to the People Are Wild podcast this morning, which is hosted by a nurse, and she does a game at the end, guess what they had stuck where in their body. They're not all rectum, because that was my first thought. And apparently there was a guy who had a piece of a Wendy's fast food plastic fork in his lung for two years.
Huh.
How do you not notice?
What?
Either when that happened, okay, how did it happen? How did you not notice you had inhaled a piece of a plastic fork? And then how did it not even enter the periphery of your consciousness for the subsequent 700 days?
There are so many questions right now.
So who? Tarari's eating out of the gutters and fighting dogs for intestines. How did he get near a gold fork?
It's pretty hard to say, isn't it?
I know. I've accepted everything else about that, but this is where I draw the line.
I guess we're about to performing for a bit.
Perhaps he picked up a wealthy patron. There could have been some rich man who wanted him to stand off to the side of the banquet hall eating houseplants or something. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. But yeah, so about a month after, Tara started having continuous chronic diarrhea and died shortly afterwards, which is not a nice way to go.
No, but it is a surprisingly common way to die. The number of people actually killed by the dehydration of diarrhea, you would be like, oh, I bet most people are killed by war. Diarrhea.
Yeah.
So right. Like worldwide throughout history, diarrhea is, I think it's malaria's first, and then diarrhea is real close second.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, whether through cholera or, whatever else.
Yeah, that does sound right. So after he died, one of the doctors essentially wanted to dissect him and figure out how he was different from the norm. And he was also curious to see whether he could find a cold fork. But the corpse rotted really quickly.
Slip that in your pocket.
Yeah. But yeah, apparently the corpse rotted really quickly, and it was rancid. And a lot of surgeons just refused to dissect it or work on it because it stunk.
Yeah, they had a very short window of time back in those days.
Yeah, apparently he rotted faster than normal, so
Yeah, again, if he had an overclocked metabolism, he probably also had a higher than normal body temperature. Higher than normal temperature when he died would mean an even better environment for the microbes that break down our bodies. So they were just having a field day.
Yeah, yeah. During the autopsy, essentially, his gullet was found to be abnormally wide. And apparently when his jaws were opened, the surgeons could see a broad canal down to his stomach. I think one thing I read was that they could fit a 20 centimeter diameter tube, I think 20 centimeter, down his gullet.
So that's about 8 inches for those of us not in the home counties.
Yeah. It might be bigger than that, I'm not sure. But it was a lot. And his body was essentially filled with pus. His liver and gallbladder were super enlarged.
Yeah, his stomach would have to be eating that digestion.
Yeah, his stomach was massive and covered in ulcers. And essentially, it filled most of his abdominal cavity. The fork was never found, though.
There goes the fork theory. I mean, if he was able to pass a wooden box, he probably could have passed the fork. Especially if it was, like, tines back. If it was, like, handle first, would have been no sweat.
Yeah. And that's all I actually have for Tara. But I do have a couple of other interesting edible people, I guess. Anyway.
People renowned for eating.
Not edible people. That's different.
We're all edible. Yeah.
So, there's one guy that was written by Drake, and he described the person as a man of 27 who pursued the vocation of a sword swallower. He had swallowed a gold watch and chain with a seal and key attached, and at another time he swallowed 34 bullets and voided them by the anus.
Say again, he swallowed 34 bullets and what?
Voided them by the anus.
Okay, I think that would have been implied. I'm not sure why he included it, and I'm not sure why you included it.
I read it, and I was just like, I have to use those exact words. Like, it's in front of me, I have
to
read it.
It's a very posh way of saying shit them out.
Yeah, and apparently in August 1819, in one day and night, he swallowed 19 pocket knives and 41 copper cents.
That's not healthy.
No. I generally say that swallowing one pocket knife is probably not great for you.
No, and I mean, pocket knives these days, you know, they have a little springy bit to them so that they stay closed. That's a modern invention, I would think. So, I'm just asking for trouble, that is.
Yeah.
Even leaving aside the issue of the heavy metal poisoning.
Apparently, after his death here, his esophagus was found normal, but his stomach was enlarged enough. It reached almost to the... It says spine of the ilium, but there's a different word for it. That's essentially like part of the pelvis.
Yeah, your ilium, your ilia are... Your pelvis is made of three bones. There's the sacrum in the center, which is the little wedge-shaped bone, which is five fused vertebrae at the bottom of your spine. And then on either side of that are the big elephant ear ilia. So if this went to where his spine... So about to the back top of his pelvis... is from my understanding from your description. So his stomach is going from just under his sternum down and back to the top of his pelvis. It's basically just excluding all the other organs from the abdominal cavity.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the anterior superior spine or something like that. But
the front and top.
Exact term is.
Well, anterior would be front and superior would be top. My first husband had four spinal surgeries. So you want to talk? You want to talk lumbar spine? We can talk lumbar spine.
Yeah, yeah. I have no idea. Apparently, the knives found in his stomach weighed over a pound. I'm not sure how much that is in kilos, but it's.
Oh, I always get it back. Okay, 1 kilo is 2.2 pounds. So 1 pound is just under half a kilo.
So yeah, apparently in his exhibitions, he'd allow spectators to hear the click of his knives and feel them after he swallowed them.
Yeah, just like let them poke around.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I would do that, but I would charge them extra. It's going to be like, you know, an extra nickel if you want to poke the knives.
Yeah, yeah. I also read about apparently as a boy that was 12 years old that apparently in 6 days would eat 384 pounds and 2 ounces of food, but would constantly vomit.
Very specific measure. Look at 384 pounds and 2 ounces.
It was in like a book of medical anomalies.
He said he was 12, so if he was of average height and build, he was probably, I don't know, like 5'6", and let's say 90 to 100 pounds, depending. So about three times your body weight in a week.
And yeah, so it's there have been a few cases of like excessive eating and stuff. Excessive thirst is a thing as well. Like, well, I read about it a few times. There's one guy that was 58, like, who wouldn't go for a night without drinking an entire pail of water. So that's probably about a few pints.
One could assume actually a couple of gallons or, you know, several liters.
Yeah, apparently his daily ration of water was 8 to 12 gallons.
Yeah, I would think that that might be diabetes insipidus, which is not the diabetes you think of when you think of diabetes, but you can think of the regular diabetes as sugar diabetes and diabetes insipidus as water diabetes, where essentially your kidneys aren't doing their job correctly. And so you just need constant water in and naturally, of course, a constant water coming out.
So, yeah, there have been a few interesting appetites out there.
Well, do you know about Monsieur Mange-Tout?
I know the name, but I don't know what, I can't remember exactly what that was.
Monsieur Mange-Tout, a man named Michel Lotito, ate an airplane.
Yes, I do know that one.
Yeah, he shows up on like Ripley's Believe It or Not. And
yeah, he eats solid metal and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, he's eaten bicycles and all kinds of shopping carts. And over the course of, I'll have to look up what span of time, ate an entire Cessna dual prop airplane.
Yes, I remember from the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yeah. Sure. I would suspect that that's one of those categories that they've shut down. Guinness has actually removed or forbidden any number of record categories over the last decade just to try to stop people from doing really stupidly dangerous stuff in an attempt to get their name in the book.
That makes sense. I do remember there being one that was chainsaw juggling, so...
They use special chainsaws for that. That one's not actually as dangerous.
Okay.
Being a burlesque dancer, I also know a lot of sideshow performers. So I've been thinking about all the people I know who are sword swallowers or who stick their fingers and tongues in mouse traps, people who can swallow razor blades and all that kind of stuff. So this was in my wheelhouse for sure.
Yeah. All right. But yeah, I think
it's in their wheelhouse. I let them do it and I cheer.
Yeah.
I'm not doing any of that. Unless you deep fry it or dip it in chocolate, I'm not eating it.
Yeah, cool. So I think that's all I actually have for my section. So I think we'll cut to music and come out of yours before I die of this illness.
Yeah, well, don't die in the next half hour. We'll be fine.
It's fine. I will probably be as talkative, but cool. So we'll cut to music and be right back. And we are back. So, Moxie, do you want to save me from my illness and take it away?
Yep, I'll take over from here. My working name is Moxie LaBouche, which means Moxie the Mouth. You'll be lucky if you can get a word in edgewise. So you just sit back, relax, and enjoy as I tell you the story of a clan of inbred cannibalistic highwaymen in the Scottish countryside. Fun for the entire family. The clan takes its name from one of the progenitors, Sawney Bean. Sawney is a nickname that is somehow a short form of Alexander. I read the explanation and it still makes no sense.
Wait, what?
Somehow Sawney is a short form of Alexander or Alistair.
Sure, why not?
When you get into the Gaelic, all bets are off.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, hop on YouTube and look for a clip from Lee Mack about Irish names, and you just have a good 5 minutes laugh right there. You know how Siobhan should be pronounced, Siobhachon.
Oh yeah,
but yeah, that aside. So Alexander Sawney Bean was born in the latter part of the 14th century in East Lothian, Scotland. What's cool, tying this down to me, I live right near an area called Mid-Lothian, and none of us here in America know where the word Mid-Lothian came from. It wasn't until I saw it in a really old, a reference to like a 14th century place in the British Isles. I'm like, oh, So it's the middle part of Lothian. Well, there you go. Okay. Bean was born into a poor family of laborers in an agricultural community and was subject to severe beatings by his father, generally owing to an innate apathy for hard work. And he wasn't particularly keen on following the rules either. So it didn't take long for him to abandon his trade as a tanner, and he took up with a woman called Black Agnes. Agnes Douglas was thought by many in the area to be a witch, and some speculate that she may actually have been a murderess before even meeting Sawney Bean. When locals began to accuse her of conducting human sacrifices and conjuring demons, the pair moved to Ayrshire, Scotland. Specifically, they set up housekeeping in a seaside cave. Benane Cave was difficult to find if you didn't already know where it was, because its entrance would be completely submerged when the tide came in. This made it very defensible and definitely a good place to hide. And the cave extended more than a mile into the cliffs, with lots of side passages and little alcoves and nooks in which for them to hide, to stow their ill-gotten booty, and to eventually raise a family. Disinclined to work for money and lacking any land on which to produce food for himself and his wife, Sawney and Agnes turned to banditry. They preyed on travelers, seeking out easy targets like people traveling alone. And to help ensure that they wouldn't be caught later, they left no survivors. History doesn't record which one of them had the epiphany to solve their witnesses will get us hanged and we don't have any food problems with one fell swoop. But somewhere along the line, they decided to start eating their victims. Now, an adult human body provides about 30,000 calories from the meat, which is just the muscle. You can get a further 50,000 calories from fat. So a human victim is a pretty good source of food. There's also great nourishment to be had from bone marrow, brains, and other internal organs, which are definitely in play in Scotland, which is, after all, the land of the haggis. With the victims providing more meat than the pair could eat at once, and with the availability of future meat being unpredictable, they also pickled, smoked, dried, and otherwise preserved it, just as you would venison or beef. But there would soon be more than enough mouths to feed on this macabre diet of theirs. Sawney Bean and Black Agnes would eventually have 8 sons and 6 daughters, all of which were raised to be part of this cannibal highwayman lifestyle. And as their children grew and were incorporated into the killings, they would go off and hunt in their own little groups, so that way the clan could cover more ground and increase their take. Eventually, Bean wanted to expand the family and encouraged his children to have children with each other. It's sort of Hannibal Lecter meets Flowers in the Attic. But according to a Bean family ledger that was allegedly found many years later, Bean and Agnes would have 18 grandsons and 14 granddaughters, now bringing the Bean clan to a total of 48 inbred cannibalistic highwaymen. And as the family grew, naturally so did their appetite. The men would go out on raiding parties, taking on as many as 6 victims at once in ambush attacks. The bodies would be brought back to the cave to be prepared for the larder by the womenfolk. I can't harp on them too much about the strict adherence to traditional gender roles, not in the face of everything else they're doing. Well, I do want to interject an aside about the physical effects of inbreeding and of cannibalism. Close breeding, which is the mating of a brother and sister, or line breeding, which is the mating of a parent and child, are very common in the animal world, both wild and domestic animals. But genetic diversity is a key factor in most healthy life forms. Inbreeding results in homozygosity, a state of possessing 2 identical forms of the same gene, which increases the chances of offspring being affected by deleterious recessive traits. And this usually leads to what's called inbreeding depression, a decreased biological fitness of the population to survive and reproduce. We can see this in humans in European history with the Habsburg dynasty, particularly in King Charles II of Spain, who had a jaw that was so overgrown and deformed that he couldn't eat and constantly drooled. He had a mind so feeble it was deemed not worth educating. He had barely enough motor control to walk on his own, malformed organs, and thankfully was sterile. But breeding communities don't have to be restricted to one founding couple for diseases to proliferate. The Amish communities of North America have a much higher than average incidence of a certain form of dwarfism, Ellis van Creveld syndrome, because one of the founding members carried the allele, or the genetic marker, for it. Likewise, the Afrikaners of South Africa are more likely to develop Huntington's disease than the general population, because they descended from a small group of insular Dutch settlers. Now, the consumption of human flesh is not in and of itself dangerous, but it's the consumption of the brain that can get you into trouble. Now, you see a slight reference to this if you've seen the film The Book of Eli. I have a cat named after him because he had a kind of a messed up eye. No spoilers. Yeah. The protagonists notice tremors in the kindly old couple who are helping them, this couple that has somehow survived in the middle of nowhere with numerous graves dug out back of the house. This was probably a depiction of Kuru. It's a rare fatal neurological disease first observed in the Foray people of Papua New Guinea. They practice a funereal endocannibalism. They eat the corpses of their dead as part of their mourning rituals. The name Kuru means, in their language, to tremble or to shiver. Symptoms include loss of coordination, involuntary movement, behavioral and mood changes, dementia, and difficulty eating. There is no cure known for it, and it's usually fatal within 1 year of contraction, either from the damage to the central nervous system or from malnutrition because the person is unable to eat properly. Though interestingly, scientists studying the Foray people have found that an increasing number of them carry a genetic marker that makes them resistant to Kuru. Huh. So there is the possibility that even if they had not been told what was happening by, you know, doctors, white doctors from the West, and encouraged to stop eating their dead, that they may well have been able to evolve beyond the Kuru. Eating brains might also lead you to be afflicted with variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is also transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, essentially mad cow disease in humans, which is also incurable. So on the whole, don't eat people if you can avoid it.
It's good advice.
Yeah, and if you have to, if it's like, you know, soccer team in the Andes, try to avoid the brains if you can.
Yeah, it's a prion disease, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It is a prion disease. Yeah. Now back to the bean family and their fun-loving, outdoorsy, robbing, killing, eating, inbreeding lifestyle, which they managed to carry on like that for over 25 years, which is an almost unthinkable length of time for what was essentially a killing spree. Mm. But even with their highly defensible home base, it couldn't last forever. Local authorities amassed a staggering number of missing persons, with some accounts putting it into the thousands. Bones and body parts would wash up on local beaches with clear signs of cut marks where the flesh had been stripped from the bone. Rumors and theories swirled. Local people accused one another. One common story was that local innkeepers had been robbing and killing the missing people. And those stories were so pervasive that some innkeepers had to close up shop and get out of the business for fear of being lynched. Any number of mystical beasts were also blamed, such as red caps, which are murderous goblin-like creatures, or kelpies, shapeshifters who live in lakes and rivers. Even though the Sawney Bean clan had made it into a third murderous generation, it all came crashing down around them one evening in 1430, when they attacked a man and his wife who were returning home from a nearby fair. Some of the Beans pulled the woman from her horse, stripped and disemboweled her before the others had even wrestled the other man off of his horse. Wow. Realizing, yeah, They work fast.
That's efficiency.
Teamwork makes the dream work. Realizing the fate that was about to befall him, the man fought desperately to escape. As he struggled with the cannibal highwaymen, a group of 20 or so people also returning from the fair happened upon the scene. After a brief and violent exchange, the Sawneybean clan found itself, for the first time ever, outnumbered, and retreated to their cave, leaving behind the mutilated body of the woman, dozens of witnesses, and one very angry husband. The husband went before the chief magistrate of Glasgow, who put this story together with the long list of missing persons and reports of found body parts. The magistrate took the matter straight to King James I, who assembled 400 soldiers, a band of local volunteers, and a retinue of tracking dogs, and descended on the area. The men couldn't find the cave, but there was no hiding the combined scent of dozens of filthy humans, pickling barrels, and rotting flesh from the noses of the dogs. Carrying torches and drawn swords, the troops entered Benane Cave and proceeded down the mile-long, twisting passage into the inner depths of the Sawneybean family lair. Nothing could have prepared them for the sight that greeted them. Row upon row of human limbs and body parts hung from the ceilings and walls like cuts of meat in a butcher's shop. Pickling barrels lined the walls. Other areas of the cave were strewn with bundles of victims' clothing, piles of watches and rings, and everywhere were discarded bones from previous feasts. After a brief fight, the entire Sawneybean family, all 48 of them, were arrested and marched off to Edinburgh by the king himself. Their crimes were considered so heinous that the normal justice system was abandoned, and the entire family was sentenced to death. The following day, the 27 men met a fate similar to that of many of their victims. Their legs and arms were cut off, and they were left to slowly bleed to death as the women of the family watched. Some accounts even hold that their genitals were cut off and thrown into a fire. The 21 women were then burned like witches in a huge bonfire. It's said that during the entire execution, which would have to have taken several hours to complete, not one member of the Bean family showed a single sign of fear or remorse. In fact, they were constantly hurling obscenities at their captors. Up until his final breath, Alexander Sawney Bean repeated the phrase, "It isn't over. It will never be over." And though the entire clan died that day in 1430, or so the legend goes, they've lived on in popular culture. If you picture this story taking place in a dry desert rather than a misty cliffside, you have George Romero's The Hills Have Eyes. Sawneybean's influence could also be seen in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, with a little sprinkling of killer Ed Gein for good measure. And arguably, it may also have been an influence on what I think is the best episode of the original X-Files, Home, about a murderous inbred family, though they didn't really seem to hint much at cannibalism in that one. But still, if you're going to watch one episode of The X-Files, make it Home.
That was great. Sorry I was really quiet for it. I was just trying to sniffle.
We're just letting you rest and get your strength back.
Yeah, that was great. I didn't know a lot of that, actually. I read the basics of the Sawneybean stuff before, but it was a while ago. I don't think I knew before at all.
Arguably, it's probably more myth than it is factual tale, since the first written record that we can still find was in what is called the Newgate Calendar in 1843. Newgate calendars and the Newgate novels were these salacious records of people who were being hanged and their crimes, that also gave us penny dreadfuls, which were very popular in the working classes. And, you know, when you think about how many true crime podcasts and stories of the macabre are out there now, we have not lost our taste for it in the slightest.
No. So I think on that, we'll cut the music and then come out with an outro. So yeah, see you in a sec, guys. And we are back. So, Moxie, you want to
Do you have any last comments or anything?
Well, I want to thank you for letting me onto your show, for inflicting me on your audience, and surprising me with one of my favorite topics that never comes up, our hungry little friend Terrare.
Yes. Yeah, hopefully that came out okay, because I was dying for the majority of it, but it'll probably be okay in edit after editing.
Yeah, that's what editing software is for.
That way.
We'll fix it in post.
Yeah, fix it in post.
Yeah, which we have a rule around here. Those words are only allowed to come out of your mouth if you're the person who is fixing it in post.
Yeah.
Nobody else is allowed to say it.
Essentially, yeah. It's like, I do a lot of post-editing. Yeah. It should be okay.
Yeah, well, I had the distinct honor of producing the only author-approved Game of Thrones burlesque show. Huh. And we actually got to go to Mr. Martin's theater in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and play for him. And with that, such an auspicious circumstance, we made a documentary. And I naturally was the one who had to edit that, teach myself video editing while editing this documentary. And that is why the phrase, "we'll fix it in post," is very, very carefully regulated in my presence.
Understandable.
I put 150 hours into that, and it never got good.
Oh no!
Well, my computer can't hold the entire file. I had to work on it in sections. So then, when you do actually put it together, you have these wild disparities in volume between the different scenes. Damn it! I'm just trying to make a documentary about strippers going to meet George R.R. Martin. Is that asking so much?
Yeah, that's not great if you can't hold the entire file. That hurts.
Well, luckily it does much better with the audio editing, which I use to make my podcast, Your Brain on Facts, available on all popular podcast platforms, probably on the very app that you're listening to this fine program on. You can also find it at yourbrainonfacts.com. Look me up on Facebook, facebook.com/yourbrainonfacts, or on Twitter, at Moxie LaBouche. Don't worry about the spelling. By the time you get to the L, Twitter should find it for you.
Excellent. So, that was actually my next question. Right, so you've got your plugs started. So I'll just throw in a few plugs. It'll be less elegant than yours, but I'll be there anyway. So.
Well, my mother had been in radio. So all of us instinctively, both nature and nurture, myself and my five sisters, we can immediately drop into our radio voice.
Oh, yeah. It's like, I'm normally a bit more on the ball, but not today. But yeah, anyway.
Damn fragile mortal bodies.
I know.
Where is that singularity they were promising us?
Exactly.
Need to upload my consciousness into something. Of course, then if you think about the way your cell phone behaves after you update it, I don't know if uploading your consciousness into the cloud is really going to solve anything.
It depends which update you're on, really.
I got to reboot my phone like 3 times a week just to keep it functioning. I'm not trusting it with my consciousness.
Yeah.
So if you're not already a fan of Tom Scott's YouTube channel, first off, you've wasted a large portion of your life, but there's still time to fix it. He's got an amazing video on there, which is like the kind of the user manual to someone who's just been uploaded to the cloud. And it's based on the level of service they can afford to pay.
Oh yeah, you should check out Exerbia on YouTube as well. He's super good for stuff like that. He's got some really funny videos. But yes, anyway, my plugs will be the meta.ly network. Go from meta.ly, you can find a bunch of really cool true crime podcasts over there. You can find me on social media at facebook.com/bloodandrocks or Twitter and Instagram at thebloodyrocks. We also have email, which you can message me about anything on at botrpodcast@gmail.com. We have a Patreon if you want to support the show at patreon.com/bloodandrocks. I think that's pretty much everything I have.
Yes, send him money. He needs tissues and cough syrup.
Pretty much.
For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can keep a podcast host from dying.
Yeah. And on that, I think we can call it. So thank you for listening. Rate, view, subscribe. Don't forget to tell your friends. And have a great week. I'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.